You're listening to 209 Radio, and this is 103.5 FM, so far and yet so near. Hello there, I am Derek Thorne.
And I am Hannah Higginson. Welcome to a special Valentine's edition of the show. And yes, you've guessed it, today we will be talking about love. The next half hour, though, will not be a series of slushy love songs and anecdotes, though these things have their place, of course. Today, we hope to think about love from a global perspective by considering it from the viewpoint of some of the world's religions.
And in order to do this, we've invited along to the 209 studio today a number of guests. We tried to invite a diverse range of people, and unfortunately, representatives of the Buddhist and Jewish faiths were unable to attend and probably not able to fit in here either. So we're lucky today to have with us Shilpa Shah, who grew up within the Hindu community here in Cambridge. Hello there to you.
Hello.
Richard Higginson, a curate at St Philip's Church on Mill Road and also lecturer in ethics at Ridley Hall Theological College. Is that all right?
That's right.
Hey, very good. Okay, Sura Kadiri, who's a postgraduate student at Cambridge University. Welcome to you.
Hi.
And Virginia Barnes, who is a part-time teacher and member of the Baha'i community in the Cambridge area. So welcome to you as well.
Hi.
Hello, everyone. Thanks all for joining us. So maybe, Richard, if we can start with you, if you can start by telling us what you would say the key elements of love are from a Christian perspective.
Yes, thank you. Well, within Christianity, there are various different types of love, and I'd like to highlight four types tonight. First of all, there's romantic love, or eros, to use the Greek word, and that's probably the sort of love we think of first and foremost on St. Valentine's Day. And that's love that is attracted by another person, that delights in him or her, and desires him or her for oneself. And in the Hebrew scriptures, we have the Song of Songs, which is an erotic love poem, the refrain of two young people passionately in love and waxing lyrical over each other's physical characteristics in the most lavish imagery. That's an example of romantic love in the Bible. Secondly, there's friendship or philia, that's the Greek word. Friendship that's not sexual, but like eros, is usually based on something we find attractive in another. Shared interests or concerns. Feeling comfortable in their company. We're able to laugh and share at a deep level with people we know as friends. Jesus had a relationship of friendship with his disciples. He calls all of them his friends, notably on the night before he died, but he clearly had a close friendship with three in particular: John, James, and Peter. And then there's family love. Storge is the Greek word here, that special bond of love within a family, the care you feel for someone who's your own flesh and blood. And there's a very strong theme in the Bible of love of father for son, even the son who has gone astray. Think of the parable of the prodigal son, the son who asserts his independence, demands and then wastes his inheritance, but is still welcomed home by the waiting father. Then fourthly, there's the most demanding sort of love, what I call an all-encompassing love, and here the Greek word is agape, love for the unlovely, the undeserving, love that doesn't depend on something attractive in the one being loved. And Christians believe this is the sort of love God shows to us human beings as sinners. He demonstrates his love for us in the fact that Christ died for us. It's a love that includes enemies as well as neighbours. It's a love that goes on willing the best for people, even when they make things very difficult.
Okay, if it's all right, I'd just like to move over,
sure.
Because these themes of many different kinds of love turn up in, I think, all the faiths that were represented today. So, Sura, if I could turn to you. I mean, in Islam, then, there are also different kinds of love, are there?
Absolutely. I mean, the theme of love is a vast one in the Quran and in the histories of the story of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. There is, of course, as in Christianity, there is a love for the divine, a love for one's creator, and a love that is, of course, reciprocated, because if we are able to love our creator, who is perfect, he is able to love with an intensity that is greater than we can manage. And, of course, there is love for his messengers and for his who, you know, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who we believe is his final prophet. But there is also the different types of love that one encounters on a day-to-day basis. There is love for one's parents, which is meant to be a deep love and a respect and a gratitude for the sheer energy and time and sacrifice, you know, financial sacrifice that they invest in us as, you know, to make us who we are, and especially for one's mother, because of the pain, the physical pain, as well as the kind of emotional output that she goes through, just to kind of bring us into the world and bring us up. There is, of course, love for one's friends, a respect for people and for their property. And this, of course, we believe is enhanced by love for the divine. I mean, sometimes people feel an impulse to hurt one another, but because they love God, who they know is watching, and desire his pleasure above all things, you know, they stop themselves stealing something that belongs to somebody else. Or,
can I just jump in there? That's really interesting. Maybe we can talk about this love for the divine within the Hindu context. Is there talk of that within your holy scriptures?
Yes, well, the Bhagavad Gita, which is one of the holy books that Hinduism is based on the idea of devotional love between Krishna, who is the human incarnate form of the god Vishnu, and Arjuna, who is his disciple, who is speaking to on the battlefield. The devotional form of love is called Prakriti. So it's Hindus would take form in the form of ceremonies such as pujas and in singing devotional songs, and also in meditation as well, sort of one-on-one kind of. You don't have to go through a priest, or you don't have to go through anything. You can literally, you and God and your relationship with him.
Excellent. And lastly, I'd like to bring in you, Virginia, from the Baha'i perspective. Now, firstly, I'm aware that some listeners may not be aware of what the Baha'i faith is, so I wonder if we could have a very quick run-through of the Baha'i faith. Could you just give us a quick description, please?
Well, the Baha'i faith is really the newest of the world religions, and it was founded in the middle of the 19th century, and the name of the founder was Baha'u'llah, and we believe in one God like all the other major religions, but we believe that from time to time we need a sort of a spiritual renewal, and that Baha'u'llah has really brought us, the essence of all religions is the same, but we need different social laws as mankind progresses, and this is the beginning of mankind's coming of age.
Okay, and how widespread is the Baha'i faith?
Well, it's the second most widespread religion after Christianity throughout the world, but of course not numerically. There are about 6-7 million Baha'is, throughout the world.
And then, talking about love then, we've asked everyone here today to bring a reading with them, and you've actually got a reading with you. And I think that one kind of reflects on love in the wider sense. Would you like to read it for
us? Well, I've got one that said, "The first sign of love, of faith, is love. The message of the holy divine manifestations is love. The phenomena of creation are based upon love. The radiance of the world is due to love. The well-being and happiness of the world depend upon it."
Mm. And I suppose this kind of gives a sense that love is very, very powerful. I mean, going back to you, Richard, I mean, would you agree, is love the most powerful thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think Christians have always seen it as the greatest of all the virtues. And that's partly because Jesus, when asked to sum up the law, he summed it up in the twofold commandment: to love God with all your heart, soul, strength and mind, and to love your neighbour as yourself. And I'm sure Jews actually would agree with that synopsis, if you like, of the law and the prophets.
Mm. Okay.
So yes, it's absolutely central.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd like to share a quote with everyone that I found when I was sort of doing some research for this. It's a quote by Jonathan Swift, who was the writer of Gulliver's Travels, that is: "We have just enough religion in the world today to make us hate, but not enough to make us love one another." And I think that sort of the common layman on the street maybe would see religion as being a decisive force rather than the uniting force. But what you all seem to be saying is that there's actually, you know, love is central to all your religions and there's lots of common threads. Would you agree with that?
with the quote from Jonathan
Swift, or more that there's common that there's common threads.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I happen to think that there's enough religion in the world to make heaven on earth, but there aren't enough people taking it seriously enough and seeing it for what it really is and adhering to it in the correct way. And I mean, this you can see on a world level, you can also see on a microcosmic level. There are divisions within communities and so on, certainly within Islamic communities, that I would say are very far removed from what God's teachings tell us. I mean, if it's all right, if I could bring in the example of marriage. We were discussing earlier that you were asking whether it was problematic when people sort of marry out of their culture or out of their faith, as it were, but in a way that is still Quranically sanctioned. And the answer is, of course, that yes, there is lots of uproar about that, but that it's for the wrong reasons. It's an uproar that shouldn't take place at all. For example, you'll find many... you'll find that things, you know, there could be kind of division within communities over the fact that, one person from a Muslim from one part of the world wants to marry a Muslim from another part of the world, but the family had their heart set on, somebody from their own tribe. So this is a kind of tribal thinking that does not exist in the faith, but that is kind of acting as a blight on the faith, because, of course, naturally, people who profess to be Muslims and who are, but who have... who are not adhering to certain essences within the faith have kind of given it a bad name, and so people say, well, look, even on this level, religion is divisive and so on.
So maybe I could bring you in there to in connection with the Hindu community. Is that something as well to do with marriage? You mentioned earlier that there was a division between the older and the younger generation, and that marriage, love, was something that was organised almost before, but now that it's more organic and growing.
I totally agree with what Sura said about how what religion dictates about marriage and what community dictates about marriage can be quite different things often, and what they say about love as well. But within the Indian community, the more older traditional view often says that marriage should be based on basically anything apart from actual love between a man and a woman. Partners will be chosen by their families to match up according to, in some places it still happens according to caste, because Hinduism splits people into caste, according to what the family does, what the background is, according to the education of the people. In some places, height and fairness of skin actually matter as well, which is a little bit ridiculous. But definitely here, and also in India, where I've spent a few months living there, attitudes are changing, and people are beginning to see through that, and a different concept of love is definitely evolving.
These changes in attitude, I mean, is this turbulent at all? I mean, do you find that people who are older members of the community kind of reject them?
I think so. I think there's a lot of prejudices and a lot of sort of ingrained thinking that, I mean, I would say that being from a younger generation,
sure.
I guess. So that might be a slightly biased comment on my part. But it definitely can cause problems between families. But then I think that I've definitely found that there are many families out there which are willing to adjust, especially from my point of view, being from an Indian background but living here, you know, if you're part of that diaspora, living in a different place, then your views and your traditions will have to adjust to accommodate where you're living and the traditions there.
Well, let's focus on marriage a bit, and I think we're going to talk a bit about marriage from everyone's point of view. Virginia, marriage is obviously an important part of the Baha'i faith. So tell us a bit about how the process works in that faith.
The founder of the Baha'i faith, Baha'u'llah, said that really marriage was a fortress for well-being, and that this really is the foundation of a harmonious society. However, Baha'is do actually, although you're free to choose anybody who is pleasing to you, you have got to have the consent of both parents, if they're living, for this marriage to work in a harmonious way. And there's no real fixed traditional ceremonies that you have to go through other than a marriage ceremony, which you have to is performed in front of two witnesses, And in those, the couple involved have to, all they have to say in front of the witnesses is, "Verily, we are content with the will of God." Mm. Most Baha'i marriages do have really beautiful prayers and readings from the writings, but they don't have to. They could have poems, they could have just music, they can have anything they like, which is, it's very exciting because it means that people are very creative in how they celebrate their marriage.
Okay, and Richard, I gather you've also brought with you a reading from the marriage ceremony, so would you care to give us that?
Yes, well, the point I want to make, which links up to what I said at the start, mm-hmm. is that the different types of love I talked about are actually all needed to make a good marriage. A marriage that will last cannot be based on romantic love alone, although that's an important component. It also needs loyalty, companionship, and a willingness to stick up with things when things get tough, because relationships can be difficult, and there needs to be a self-sacrificial element in a marriage relationship as well. And this is reflected, I think, in the Christian marriage service, where the couple make promises for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish till death us do part. So there is a recognition there that it may not all be roses, there could be some thorns and thistles as well, but nevertheless you're making a commitment to stick with your partner.
Excellent. And maybe now we turn to you, Sarah. What sort of form does the marriage ceremony take in Islam? It's actually something I've realised I know nothing about, and maybe many of our listeners don't as well.
Well, possibly a little bit like in the Baha'i faith, the marriage ceremony, as stipulated, you know, by the teachings of Islam, is fairly simple. You are married by an individual who is not necessarily... there is no clergy as such in Islam, so, members of the community who are kind of prominent for their good, you know, community works and so on. Sometimes it can be the imam of a mosque are asked to join two people in marriage, and there have to be two witnesses present. After this marriage has taken place, usually there's, you know, it's nice if people can, just to kind of make it a happy time, to have a big meal and feed, members of the community as many as they can, but of course more elaborate ways of celebrating marriages, and this is, you know, within the permissible, have developed in different cultures. So brides will wear different things in different countries, different Muslim countries, etc. Different food will traditionally be prepared and so on. Although there is, it is important, as with all things in life, not to be extravagant and not to do things for show, which perhaps people have lost sight of. It's meant to be. I mean, ceremonies are meant to kind of mark it as a happy occasion and an official blessed union, but not to go too far. And like Virginia was saying, it marriage. Does and should form the cornerstone of a harmonious society, and it's something that's very, very highly desirable for people who can marry, parental consent is obviously highly desirable, if not sometimes essential, because where you're creating a new harmonious unit, you don't want to be severing various others in order to achieve that. It would be nice if there was some kind of, you know, continuity and harmony. I have a little something to read out, but
share it with us.
Well, this is a quotation from an English translation of the Quran that I've brought with me, and it's actually something that people often put on their wedding invitations, just to remind the guests, you know, what we're all here to witness. And I'll quote. "And from amongst his signs is that he created for you spouses from your own selves, that you may dwell with them in tranquility, and he has brought between you love and mercy. Truly in this are signs for a people who reflect." And the beauty of this is that we're reminded that love is something that's a divine gift. I mean, God is ultimately one of two of the attributes he ascribes to himself in the Quran, are that he is the loving and the merciful. And so love and mercy, the ability to feel that for one another, are gifts that God has given to humanity. so that this sort of tranquility can be created. And elsewhere in the Quran, very interestingly, there is the analogy that husbands and wives are like each other's garments, which sounds unusual, but is actually a very beautiful analogy, really. Because, I mean, if you think of what a garment does, a garment is something that protects you from extreme weather, extreme cold, extreme warmth. And this is what a loving relationship does. It protects you from the daily and discomforts in this world. It's also something that bends when you bend and stretches when you stretch. So it's something that accommodates you. And it's something also that adorns you. And in terms, if you think of character, husbands and wives really see very deeply into each other's characters and are able to gently redress each other's flaws and tell each other when they've got, you know, bad habits, and also to pass on good habits to each other. And therefore they beautify each other's characters and help them take a step towards perfection.
Thank you very much. Excellent. And I wonder if you turn to you, Shilpa, as well, because I'd also like to be enlightened about marriage ceremonies in Hinduism. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
I think they're quite different to the ones that we've heard of, that they're a lot more elaborate, there's a lot more symbolism, I think, in terms of what is actually carried out and what's done and what the actual things that are used, like almost props, kind of. But I think the main aspect of it is that the couple are actually, their souls are supposed to be uniting in front of God, which is who is represented by the fire, holy fire, as light in the couple's lives, and symbols such as a garland of flowers, which the bride and the groom will put and place over each other. Are meant to represent unity, just as the rings, like the circularity of rings, are unity and everlasting love. And also the bride and groom will both eat something sweet, such as a mixture of yogurt and honey, to represent the sweetness and happiness and harmony for the years and years to come. And they will also actually be tied. They will actually have cloth placed across both their shoulders, which will actually be tied physically to represent the union. And then this cloth they will keep whilst they're married as well.
Seems there's some really strong symbolism there, actually. I never knew about that. And can I ask Virginia and Richard, I mean, are there examples in yours? Virginia, perhaps, are there any strong symbols? Or?
No, very few strong symbols. The only thing is, I suppose, that they exchange rings.
Okay.
The couple exchange rings, but otherwise...
Okay, and that is
the
case, indeed.
Christian
yeah.
service as well.
And is that about as far as the symbolism goes, or...?
It is really, yeah. I mean, there are traditions that are built up in terms of what bride and groom wear, but there's nothing particularly Christian about that. Mm.
Maybe we could, you've all mentioned that sort of God is seen as the sort of source of, I don't know if source of love is the way you'd want me to put that, maybe we could discuss that, but do you think, Richard, through living a spiritual life, that enables you to love more deeply, and then maybe we could bring some other people in, that does it
Yes, I would say it does. I mean, I recognise that there are people of no faith who are loving people, and I can only salute them. But my own experience is that believing in God and praying to God and relating to God does help me to, I think, to be a more loving person than I would be otherwise. And very often it can be both a restraint when one is tempted to be angry and blow up with people, consciously thinking of God and the way he wants me to behave is a check. But it can also be an inspiration. It can also help me to be proactive, to think I can actively be kind to people and do things that will improve their welfare. So I would say, yes, God is the great source of love.
What about you, Cyril? What do you think? Does reason allow to love more deeply?
Oh, I would agree. I mean, from an Islamic perspective, God is the creator of all the worlds and everything, you know, and everything in the world, whether people recognize it or not. And there are certain unconditional gifts that he has bestowed while we're here on earth, such as I was saying before, the love that people are able to feel for one another. So any love in the world, I would say, is a gift from God. As Richard was saying, being more proactive and reading more about the ways in which love is best manifested according to certain according to certain religious teachings, may make one more aware and more aspiring towards kind of feeling more intense levels of love and demonstrating them.
Virginia, do you find something similar? Do you find that your spiritual life helps you to love more deeply?
Well, yes. I mean, I suppose one tries to... one has human failings and one's doing one's best, I suppose. But obviously religion helps you to focus that love and become more spiritual. And I thought I've got a quote on love that I thought may be appropriate here. It says, love gives life to the lifeless. Love lights a flame in the heart that is cold. Love brings hope to the hopeless and gladdens the heart of the sorrowful.
Okay.
And it's just that this sort of helps us to really focus and become more loving in our relationships with everybody.
Mm, okay. And Shilpa, I mean, is that from your perspective as well? Do you feel within the Hindu community, is this kind of a place where the deepest love is found, for example?
I've got a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, actually, again, and this is from Sri Krishna, who's like God speaking to his disciple. And he links the love, as in bhakti, the devotional love between a disciple and God, to the love that a person should have for the things and people and everything around them. He says, "That one I love, who is incapable of ill will, who is friendly, compassionate, living beyond the reach of I and mine, and of pleasure and pain, patient, contented, self-controlled, firm in faith, with all his heart and all his mind given to me, with such a one I am in love." And that sounds slightly strange due to the translation from Sanskrit, but basically saying that those two kinds of love complement each other and are an integral part of each other.
Thank you. Well, I think it's been a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
there have been several parallels, really.
No, absolutely. I think so. And you touched on something which was to do with loving things around you, you know, not just kind of loving people, but loving things. I wonder if we could quickly focus on that. I mean, is this true, Suru? Would you say that religion also encourages you to love kind of the things around you, the environment, animals and so on? It might be dodgy for me to start talking about loving animals on Valentine's Day, but still, I mean, in this more general sense of love and having respect for what's around you, is that something religion helps you to do?
Absolutely. I mean, Islam emphasises that we are all in this world as guests and our time here is very limited. I mean, this is not our place that we can, you know, start spreading our bad habits. And it is also God's creation. And I mean, these are all things, everything around us, the environment and animals and so on, are things that God has given us to enable us to live a comfortable life. So to treat them with disrespect and disregard is to... is to kind of show to show an attitude of not being grateful enough for what God has given us. So certainly a respect for the environment and for things and seeing them as gifts of from God is something that is essential. Although obviously an attachment to material objects and a kind of love for that is above all things is certainly not desirable.
That's a really interesting distinction you draw, actually. Yeah, kind of the do not want too much, I suppose, and so on. I mean, you were talking about, Richard, the four types of love that you began our debate with. I mean, does that come into one of those types at all, that kind of love for the wider world?
Yes, it does. I mean, the third one I mentioned, storge, some people would include things like pets under that. But certainly, yes, I mean, God loves his whole creation and commands us to as well. I mean, Christians believe human beings have been given a special place, that they are made in the image of God and they're unique in that respect. But nevertheless, part of our responsibility is to exercise stewardship over God's creation and to be good stewards, managing the earth well. And unfortunately, we haven't made a very good job of that.
Well, yes, there we go. We can go on to wider issues and so on. Shilpa, I mean, obviously, vegetarianism is apparent in Hinduism. So loving animals, for example, that's a very big thing, isn't it?
Definitely. I think that one of the central sort of cornerstones of the faith is that idea of good karma and making sure that the principle of do no harm, and that's where vegetarianism for Hindus would be very central in terms of respecting other forms of life, etc. I'm sure that's a whole other debate.
It is indeed, if we had another half hour. Okay, well, we'd like to thank all of you for coming in. You've been listening to So Far and Yet So Near, and with us today, with myself and Hannah Higginson, has been Shilpa Shah, Virginia Barnes, Sura Kadiri, and Richard Higginson, and they've been very kind to share their experiences of love within their face. Do tune in tomorrow at 6:15 for another one of our episodes, during which we will be hearing some Indian music. What else have we got coming up, Hannah?
We've got the board game, War on Terror,
that is
live
right.
We
are going to be playing a board game called War on Terror, which is made in Cambridge. So there you go. Do tune in tomorrow at 6:15. Until then, have a very nice evening, and it's a 2:09 short following this programme. Thank you for listening.
Thanks ever so much.